Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here to talk you through the Wagon Wheel, which is the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket, if we feel like it. No, if you get them in the right way and all these sorts of things. One way to get them in is when we're doing this live on YouTube, you can pop over and you can, I'm trying to think of the right word, super chat. That's the word. Is that a word? It's words put together. I'm not 100% sure what it is. But yeah, you can do that live where we're doing them. But most people send these in via the Patreon function. I'm a huge fan. Huge thanks to all those on Patreon who help support us and have helped build Good Areas and Combox into what they are becoming. Certainly that's something that is very important to us as an organization. So thank you to everyone there. But the best way to do it is to go to Good Areas Podcast and you can ask a question there. Like Cam has, he says, as a resident in Northern Territory, I can't wait for a test in Darwin. Yeah, it's one of these things where it's really important, I think, to try and get cricket out to as many places as possible. I understand that sometimes players don't like playing in random venues because of the facilities. I understand the idea of there are more people in major cities, so we should play that. But we're seeing what's happening with the Ashes next year, where there really isn't any tests in the north. I can't even remember now. I haven't looked at the schedule, but there's not a lot. I think, isn't there 4 of the 7 test matches might be in London or something ridiculous like that, including the other series. It is important, I think, for people to be able to see them. I know that a young Andy Zaltzman, for instance, got to see matches at Tunbridge Wells. He got to see the Capital Def game, for instance, against Zimbabwe. And he talks about that a lot. I've got lots of friends from regional parts of the world who've, you know, managed to go and see games because either the Big Bash or the old 92 World Cup was another period where, you know, those games were stretched around. It really is important to get the game out there while also keeping a finger on the finances and the politics of these major venues and everything else. It's probably one thing that we could do better in league cricket, I think. I'd be really fascinated to see what the future of sort of the IPL, because it's going to be the one with the most money. But, you know, I think I've seen, like, in Serbia, they play, I think it's some of their warm-up games on asphalt and outdoor courts. We have also seen, you know, the Field of Dreams in baseball and everything. I kind of feel like playing the odd game in a village setting, even if it's somewhere just like Wormsley in the UK, although I'm not the biggest fan of that ground, but something like Wormsley or something along the lines of, you know, some sort of Maidan in India or anywhere else, I think kind of matters. There's some really good country grounds in Australia that you could use as one-offs as well. Not the one that Zimbabwe beat England on and ended up getting test status off. Bed says, how in modern Britain, with all the availability of coaching facilities, are the posh kids all batters, the Asian kids spinners, and the tall northern kids seamers? How is this still a thing? So I was talking to someone about this the other day, and he was not really from a sporting background, but, you know, knew quite a bit about sport. And I was kind of explaining that because he was asking a similar kind of thing. So what happens in sport, for whatever reason, is we get into a position where we start to look for people in certain situations. So Ben, we're not really looking for, well, I should say English cricket isn't really looking for posh people to become their batters, right? But, you know, the kids who go to the posh schools around me who are obsessed with cricket spend all day quite often with access to people who can do throw downs for them at lunchtime and breaks after school. They get access to coaches all the time. There's nothing you could do to kind of replicate that outside. And so over a period of time, you know, you can actually get quite good at it. Now, it doesn't mean that the next great batter won't be from a state school or anything like that, but it's much harder. And so it makes sense that that pattern keeps happening. This is not just an English thing either, by the way. This is a thing you do see in many places around the world. Then you get the sort of more racial stereotypes, which is, I think, the Asian kids. I might have mentioned this recently, Ben, but I think the under-19 team might have had this kind of a setup. And again, it was like, oh, okay, There's an Asian kid in the team, so he must be the spinner. I heard someone joke that early on, and then that was actually the case in the under-19s. So it's that big of a trope now that everyone is aware of it. But again, think about the way that younger kids are coming through. If you are a young, either privately educated or state educated non-Asian cricketer, you probably haven't had as much access to spin and spin bowling. Like it's really clear to me when I work with the younger guys, everyone wants to be a seam bowler in England in a way that I don't quite remember as much when I was growing up. Now, maybe that was because I grew up during the Shane Warne era, right, in Melbourne. But it did feel like people wanted to be spinners as well. Feels like spin is completely a default in the UK, which is not quite the case in Asia, right? So there is also an element of that. But you're right. I wonder how many young Asian players have actually been very skillful in other ways. They can almost get pushed into spin. And then the same with the big working class northern things. But these are tropes, these are patterns that you see in a lot of different sports. And at a certain point, you have to work out the ones that you can change. I think the Asian kids and the northern kids are things you can change. But I'm not sure about, you know, just the amount of hours that some of these kids are doing at these schools with ball machines and professional coaches and incredible facilities compared to other kids who might be more talented than them but have none of those advantages. Reece says, Greg James said on Tailenders that the real problem with club cricket isn't necessarily Clicky Ponty, although he did say it was wrong. It's that it's all filmed on Frogbox and it isn't the escape from reality it once was. It's just this classist nonsense. Is this classist nonsense, or do people around him, aka the players and former players, think that about the club level? It's fascinating. I mean, I made a couple of runs a couple of years ago and I played a beautiful little club and it would have been great to have it on film, but their camera didn't work that day. I think my club doesn't really film games. I don't think we film them at all. But most clubs seem to have some sort of a camera set up as well. I don't know if that stops it from being an escapist thing for me, though. I understand what Greg is saying, and it wouldn't surprise me if there is a whole position of cricket that doesn't have that. But that was second division league cricket, right? And so I think there's a, you know, perhaps even in the past, there might have been a journalist there reporting on that, right? We're talking about a long time back, but it wouldn't have surprised me if a local newspaper reporter was doing that, you know. We quite often, especially if there was a big story, we quite often had people come to, you know, league matches to report on things. And then the higher the level of cricket, the more reporters there were. So the cameras are kind of replacing some of that. I also think it's cool that some of these things that happen in club cricket are now shared and legitimately help the growth of cricket. As I do think they do, with the ability get more people out there watching cricket, enjoying the game in any way they can. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if that you also get maybe entire leagues who don't want this to happen in the future, or clubs who don't want to do it and everything else. The only other thing I would say at the moment is, and this is more from there's less to do with what Greg is saying, but more to do with how it works is, I've been in games that have been filmed and it's not like I'm signing anything away. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think it's a bit weird that I'm not, saying that I am okay to be filmed in this situation. So I think maybe things like that will happen. But yeah, I haven't heard too many people complain about the filming at all. Maybe Brian Devine will. Anil says, what do you think of the Formula One TV universal subscription pay-per-view model of streaming? One app downloadable anywhere with fee structure, especially for test cricket. It just seems there are a lot of revenue left on the table for people living in countries where there is no broadcast. Yes. So Anil, you are running into the same problem. And I remember Gideon Haigh went to some sort of cricket media sports conference or something. And I think it might've been the guy who used to run New Zealand cricket got up and gave this great speech about how we could have a streaming platform and we could have all these sorts of things. And Gideon Haigh sort of was listening to all these people really excitedly talking about it and said to them, wait a minute, you do realize that the only reason we can't do this in cricket is because it's not all owned by one person. I've had this conversation with so many people in cricket. You know, cricket.tv, I want to say that domain was bought by the ICC 16 years ago, maybe, with the idea of doing this. How do you get them all to come in and agree to the to it has been the problem from day one. It's kind of ridiculous that we don't have it, but Formula One is owned by, well, I don't know if it's still owned by one dude, but it was owned by one dude for a very long time. He could just set things up. It's the same, even if you're an American sports league, you know, MLB, which is what the cricket.tv was based on, NBA TV, you know, all these sorts of things. They're all based on the fact that you kind of just have to deal with one league. That is not the case with cricket. And with test cricket, you would have to have a deal with everyone, right? So 11, 12 different contracts. I don't know how England and Ireland works specifically, but multiple contracts. It's just not that simple. That's why we don't have it. Absolutely, we are not monetized. This is one of the, what you're saying here is one of the reasons I keep saying that there is a big chance for franchise cricket. It's because if you had a franchise test cricket league, this, you would be able to, I think, conservatively, you'd be able to double the revenue just by a couple of like simple tweaks like this. Ian says, with your experience of working with various teams, how beneficial is the noisy wicketkeeper? Was watching a 100 game recently and the commentator quipped he could have a break and leave it to Nicholas Perham on the stump mic. Sam Billings has always been a constant talker ever since he started being skipper of various sides. Jamie Smith is often noted for being much quieter. How much difference does it make to your side in the field? I think it's one of these things, Ian, that when you have a team that is quiet, a wicketkeeper is kind of the fulcrum of the side in the field anyway, right? And so if they are constantly talking and keeping the energy up, you probably only need one or two other fielders to kind of follow suit. So I think that's a big part of it. I think another thing is that wicketkeepers are actually seeing a lot more than anything else. So if they're communicating that all the time, that's a big help for the fielding team in general, right? With someone like Jamie Smith, I'm trying to think, there was someone else. Was it Neville in Australia? It's not just that people are saying they're quiet. It's not the how loud they are or how often they talk. It's how much information is passed on. So when I worked for a cricket team, we had a choice between two wicketkeepers. And I looked at all the numbers. And I was like, to be honest, there's not much between them. This guy could bat a little bit better. This guy could keep a little bit better. If you want the extra batting, go that way. If you want the extra keeping, go this way. And what they were saying in the room was, okay, but we think that this wicketkeeper provides more in terms of tactical nous and getting angles right and, you know, talking to bowlers and all these sorts of things. And I was like, well, if you think that's the case, that would be a tiebreaker for me, right? If that is legitimately something that you think is true, then I'm more than happy to say that is a tiebreaker. I wouldn't necessarily say them being loud would be a tiebreaker, but giving information, being part of discussions and keeping people talking, all these sorts of things, I think is a really important thing. Just pure loudness, Ian, is probably nonsense. Oh, God. Sam says, as someone who's never been able to play cricket at the most basic amateur level, I wonder what kind of cricketer I would be. I think you'd be a cricketer who plays very long innings based on just the length of this piece, of this question. For context, I have cerebral palsy, and the closest I was able to get to a jar was about 9 bowling off 10 yards. Kind of slow left arm spin with a bit of drift, more often than not falling over in the follow through. Couldn't bat. I would deliberately crouch at silly point when fielding to put batters off. Conscious they're worried about hitting me. That's always a good one. I wonder if I would be good at Schrodinger's cricket, if you will. I was never bitter or bothered about not being able to play cricket properly, in fact. And I think that it gave me a bigger appreciation and love of watching it. Have you noticed the difference between the way ex-cricketers in journalism and cricket journalists with no professional background cover and see the game? Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Yes, it's very clear to me, people who have played and haven't played, the level matters, but it doesn't matter as much as you would think. I know there's a lot of former players who, if they could tell someone hasn't played, so I've noticed this a lot in commentary, they start to get a bit pissy because they realize that this person actually doesn't have some of the basic knowledge. it's not that they want these people to all be professional cricketers. Some of them do. But in general, it's more like, do they have the basic knowledge? So for instance, it's very hard to do commentary if you haven't played a lot of cricket. Because if you've played a lot of cricket, I know this sounds weird, but all the fielding positions are automatic to you. Yes, cover, point, cover point, extra cover. People can get like minor things mistaken there. Line of the ball, less so, I would say, because most people have at least watched a lot of it on TV. But the fielding one is if you've watched a lot of cricket on TV but you haven't played a lot of cricket, that can be an issue. And they do notice that. So there is a difference there when they go about it. At a certain point, I've always found it, and these are more my friends, so maybe these are the sorts of people I'm associating with. But like if I tell, you know, Gareth Batty or Robbie or Steve Harmison, right? Or Bumble. I remember Bumble came in on a conversation where I was explaining that I got some runs in a game. And he was excited because he knows what it feels like to get runs in a game. I know that sounds silly, but most of those guys are like, yeah, well done. And yes, if you push it too much and you try and big dog it a little bit, they'll be like, wait a minute, did you wear a helmet in this game? Who's the fastest bowler in this game? Blah, blah. Those sorts of things, you know, they very quickly might have a go at. But the very basic thing is, you know, runs are runs, wickets are wickets, right? I played cricket with a very good player recently and I bowled terribly and got a bunch of wickets. And he was like, no, put the ball roughly in the right area. You did the right thing. And I was like, and he was like, no, you don't, you know, enjoy the days you get wickets, right? And that, you know, this is a guy who was, you know, a fringe sort of professional himself. So I think that there is a lot of that. There is definitely a complete class of people who don't play cricket, who haven't played any cricket, and you can very much tell that in their writing. Less so in commentary, I would say, but definitely in writing, you can pick that up. One of the things that I've talked to Harsha Bogle about this, we've done a whole podcast on this, where I actually think that it's ridiculous to think that Harsha Bogle doesn't use some of his experiences as a cricketer when he commentates, right? And yet when he commentates, he never mentions that. Mark Howard does a similar kind of thing, but to be fair, Howie, I think, twists it a little bit and he'll say something along the lines, well, in club cricket, and he'll try and bring people in. I think it's one of the great things about the great cricketer is that there is a lot of things that just naturally overlap. And so, you know, it wasn't until I was in change rooms that I realized that how similar club cricket and professional cricket could still be. Obviously, there are huge differences as well. And I think it's disingenuous. And, I've called out some former commentators for this who have gone on to be known as commentators, but don't really talk about their career as much. And I'm not saying they should be doing it in every anecdote. That gets tedious, even if you're a former great player. But like, I've said this to Alan Wilkins, so I'll say this here, but Alan Wilkins took like 200 first-class wickets. And I think sometimes in the commentary, I think most people around the world don't know that Alan Wilkins was a really good professional cricketer, right? This is not just a man who happens to have a really good Welsh voice, right? This is not a man who is, you know, is good on camera and can present well. He has all of those skills, but he took... I'm going to look it up now. 243 wickets, an average of 31 in first-class cricket, over 107 matches, over, 7-8 years as a left-arm seamer. He's bringing that in. Harsha Bogle played lots of cricket when he was a kid. I played lots of cricket when I was a kid. You know, Mark Howard has played cricket. You know, it's very, you know, Adam Collins. You know, you go down the list of these people, and it's like, I don't see why we would not be using that experience, right? And also thoughts on the present cricket video game industry. So I'm going to get all this wrong, but I have Cricket 24, maybe? Ashes, one of the Ashes one, is it the 2019 one? Then I have, a more updated one of those. You know, very regularly I get contacted by people involved in cricket video games and whatever, and they sort of reach out, and then it always seems to disappear. I get the feeling is at the moment that there's a, I think the agents, and not the agents, the World Cricket Association, so the union of the players, mostly of the non-Asian teams, are trying to get together and make a big game. I think there are elements of cricket that just haven't worked. You know, I noticed with my son, he plays a lot of 2K and a lot of FIFA, and he's a bigger cricket fan. And I think that tells you a lot. And if you go back and you look at my life, outside of probably Shane Warne cricket, which was that Graham Gooch cricket? I always get the, because they changed the names. Brian Lara cricket, it's that era. I would say that me and my friends usually, like we would play like the NHL game and Madden just because they were better games, right? And I think that's the problem that has always been with video games and cricket is that if cricket fans aren't playing them, non-cricket fans aren't playing them. And I think that's where we need to get to with cricket games. Cam says, I heard another podcast arguing that the double hitters in the 100 make it a worthwhile day out compared to just attending 100 ball match. Seriously, isn't that a major argument against ODIs list A matches? Yeah, I wonder if that was the same podcast where the people said that the 100 format is a better format. Was it the Business of Sport podcast? I thought it was really bizarre. The guy was sort of saying, oh, this is a better format and it'll take over in the next couple of years. I'm like, have you read anything about cricket in the last 5 years? Yeah, also, I don't think the future of women's cricket is in the doubleheaders for many different reasons. Facilities, washouts, time, being, you know, like women's cricket cannot survive as a doubleheader sport. Cannot thrive as a doubleheader sport into the future. So yeah, I don't really understand that. But I didn't listen to that podcast unless it's the same one I stumbled across. Ben says, in the West Indies Pakistan game, we again saw bowlers standing up to wobble ball seam. It's hard to imagine a counter to this. So does the increased prevalence on this plan put risk of us back to the dark days of the pace paying pandemic? Appreciate it's still a small sample size. It's a fascinating question, Ben. I mean, I would have to say that I enjoyed the pace paying pandemic. So I'm maybe not the right person. I'm just like, can we go back to it? Yes, we can. Let me just look at, let's have a look here. I think we can do this. So if I just look at fast bowling averages. So I don't think the average ever got that far away from the pace paying. Like, it's not like the averages have gone up a huge amount either. So, okay. He says, padding for time. All right. So what year are we in here? So 2023, we saw the average go back to 32.81, which I would say is a very normal year of a batting average against seam. The year before the pace paying pandemic started, it was 32. And in 2017, it was 30.99. And so 2017 is when we start to see the effects take over, but not the full year, right? Every other year has been under 30. 2026 is 28.77. So about the same as 2022 and about the same as 2020. Nowhere near 2018 and 2019, which are 25, 26. 2024 was also 26, to be fair. So yeah, I don't think we ever really fully got out of the pace playing pandemic. Maybe in 2023, we had a brief moment where it looked like we were going to come away from it and we've swum back in, and that could be the wicketkeepers starting to do that. Might also be there are more seam bowlers now than ever before bowling it. You know, that don't remember, I can't think of too many teams who have made juiced up their wickets for seam bowling outside of South Africa. Australian wickets are like that, but they're also like that in, you know, so Australian wickets are more like that. New Zealand wickets are not. England wickets are being flattish. West Indies, maybe. Yeah, I'm just trying to do all the maths in my head. So maybe we were potentially on our way out of it. 2022 was averaging just under 30. 2023 was averaging 33. And then 2024 dropped all the way back to 26.5. I don't think that's just the wicketkeepers coming up. But yeah, we could have another dip. It's very possible. Jonathan says, could you give your 10-man team based on prowess at each fielding position minus a bowler? No, you'd have to put a bowler in. So would you put, what, Chris Jordan? Who's the best fielder off their own bowler bowling ever? Joffre's taken some great catches, but he also gets lost. I'm probably missing someone obvious there. The only criteria for making this team up is how good you were at fielding a certain position. I'm going to go ahead and put Prasanna J. Warden for keeper. Yeah, you can put him at keeper. I don't think he's the best keeper of all time, but certainly maybe the best specialist keeper of the last 30 or 40 years. At first slip, I would either have Faf, Mark Taylor, or Stephen Fleming. I like Ross Taylor a lot too. Me and Jeremy Coney argue a lot about that. I will go Faf. Second slip, I will put Mark Waugh. Third slip, I probably want someone more like Smith, Botham, Stokes, who are going to get to balls that other people aren't. So, yeah, I will go with... I'll go with Smith there. Steve Smith. Gully. I don't know if we need a gully here. He's the greatest gully of all time. Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm not sure I have a great answer for this. I suppose Jeff Marsh is one that comes to mind. Joel Garner comes to mind. It's not as an automatic a position these days. There must be someone else. Actually, can I just put like... it's going to put someone modern in. Let me skip gully. Backward point, I'll have... Backward point, I will put Jadeja because the left-hander allows you to throw at the bowler's end. And he's a better mover than Michael Clarke. Or anyone else you could put in that position. Cover point, I will have Ricky Ponting. I think AB de Villiers and Jonty Rhodes and a couple of others move better, but Ricky Ponting is more likely to hit the stumps and moves close enough to those guys. I have no idea how many I've done at the moment. Extra cover, you can have Clive Lloyd, Garfield Sobers, Roger Harper, Andrew Simons, Colin Bland. I mean, there's so many. That's almost the hardest. That and second slip are probably two of the harder ones, although I went with Mark Waugh in an instant. But there's so many options. I'm not even sure which one of them that you would go with. Yeah, and then mid-on, you don't really have like specialist fielders, so you could put someone else great in there. So let's just put Jonty in at mid-off because we can. I can't imagine we would ever have a specialist mid-on. So we didn't have AB in before. So let's chuck AB in there. Or one of those cover guys I said before. Paul Sheehan is another one. Famous old cover fielder. Short mid-wicket. I don't know why. But I like a short catching mid-wicket. Viv Richards is one that I always think of. And I was quite young when he was playing, but he just felt like he was incredible in that position. And if I wouldn't put him in, I like the idea of having Alan Border in that position because Alan Border could throw with both arms. And so, you know, it gave you the option of a runner at either end. And then I don't think we have Sobers. So we can put Sobers at what? Deep backward square leg. Short leg, you would have, I suppose you've got the... Gus Logie, David Boone, and a lot of the sort of more modern, even more the more athletic sort of short legs. But I'll put Ekna Salkar in that position because, I think he was the best ever. And I've already got Sobers out on the boundary, don't I? Leg slip. So who's a great catcher who we haven't had anywhere else? Yes, we can have leg slip. We could probably, I think if you can field it first slip, you can field it leg slip. Certainly you might at time playing cricket. So I would have at leg slip, who did I go with? Faf. So let's put Stephen Fleming or Mohammad Azharuddin, someone like that there. I have no idea if I picked 10, but I gave you most of the fielding positions. Anil says, that one's come up again, has it? Reece says, why is Virat's decline in physicality not affected him in ODIs in the same way it did in tests? I think it's not just a decline in physicality. I also think that the skills needed are a little, like the ball goes a bit straighter in white ball cricket than it does in red ball cricket after the initial swing period. And also it's more the subtle swing, I think, that caused his issues, not the fact that the ball was actually moving laterally. So I think those are some problems. I think that stacking the cordon is not a problem in ODI cricket as well. Also think he's one of those great players along the lines of Bevan and Dhoni, Shaun Masood, Sam Billings, these sorts of guys. You know, they're not great as far as overall cricket, but great at understanding the sort of the mathematics of ODI cricket and the formula of it. And that actually gives them a huge advantage over everyone else when they're playing, so that they'll have these really high averages. So I do think that's probably another part of it as well. But yeah, if you want to know the real reason, it's probably that the red ball moves for longer and you can stack the slip cord. I feel like we've got the same ones coming up over and over again. Or am I just pressing the wrong buttons here? BJ says, why the hell can't Test cricket be 100 overs a day considering there are ODI games played on fields with no lights? Yeah, it could be. Look, we can speed cricket up. We don't seem to want to speed it up all that much, or we would have. There's multiple ways that we could speed up cricket, which I don't think would cause too much of a problem. Even something as simple as, why not just bowl two overs in a row from one end, or three overs in a row from one end? We don't actually need to change ends every single over. I understand the overarching theory of that. We could have shot clocks, which, you know, baseball is now brought in for a similar kind of reason. We should start penalizing batting teams who are slowing batting the run rate down, which we never seem to ever worry about, which doesn't make any sense to me. You know, there are multiple ways we could do that. But yes, we could. James says, what business case would you use to make to the big three to convince them that the ICC should take over fixturing of international cricket? And if you succeeded and became your full-time job, what would your day one year and five-year plans look like? Day zero, sorry. I'm not sure the big three really exist anymore, so I'm not sure that's the argument. I think the main argument you could make to Indian cricket is you can make a lot more money from international cricket if it's sold in an overall package. But I also think that BCCI could make more money on their own as well. I just think they're underselling their international games a staggering amount. So, you know, they probably just need another revolution of thinking and mindset to come through that organization anyway. But yeah, let's say the big three still existed. I honestly think that Test cricket on its own could be worth double what it's currently worth. And one day cricket should be worth at least another 60 to 70% as well. And you can move that onto those teams. You can also make sure that it's run correctly, right? Like, as in that there is an actual structure to the way that cricket is currently governed and everything else. I know that gives them a power vacuum for them to be more powerful, but I don't see how they're less powerful if it's run in this way. What would day zero be for this? If the ICC had that. So day zero is just you start from the fact that there needs to be an extra fixture list and it needs to be signed on by as quickly as possible with everyone. I think year one is then ensuring that from then on in, that the IPL has a window, and that cricket is in the Olympics, that there aren't too many T20 tournaments or ODI tournaments or whatever that would be. That's probably what you're doing at the end of that first year. 5-year plan is, the 5-year plan is probably growth, right? Okay, so we've done this. How do we have multiple divisions? How do we make sure that everyone is playing Test cricket and ODI cricket and T20 cricket at a certain standard that will eventually help everyone? Hayden says, Indian players are not granted NOCs to play in overseas franchise leagues as the BCCI does not want to detract from the prestige of the IPL. Okay. If we accept this flawed logic, how does it make sense that Kuldeep Yadav, Ashutosh Sharma, and Chahal are allowed to play in Metro Bank Cup that runs concurrently with the 100? I don't know, man. Yeah, I wonder if there's a better way of doing this that helps you grow younger players and then helps you grow potential coaches. I actually think for Indian players, they're not getting the same level of depth on their experiences as like a South African player is at the moment, who's playing everywhere and learning all these different things and having to cook for themselves sometimes. And I really do think there is some things that Indian players are missing out on. But yeah, I don't really understand how these things work. But yeah, I understand not wanting Virat Kohli, Ashwin, Jadeja, Dhoni, Rohit type level players to not be in the other league. But can you not come up with a protective contract for those, for a certain amount of players? And for like, surely it helps India if Vaibhav Suryavanshi gets more experience around the world right now. And I'm not saying he can't through A cricket and everything else, but don't you want him playing against really good players on English pitches who are trying to seam the ball away from him? Hood says, you wrote so well about Viv's anticipation and athleticism when facing pace bowling, but aren't these two qualities just essential to batting against spin? Leaving aside the pitchers, coaches, and bowlers a batter grows up with, what other innate abilities and physical attributes make the batter naturally better against spin than pace, or vice versa? Yeah, so we know for a fact that great batters usually drop off against spin quicker than they do against pace. But it's a different kind of first movement, right? So one of the reasons we believe they drop off against spin versus pace is that you actually physically have to move. If you're facing great pace bowling, you're actually not moving all that much. So yes, there is something about Viv Richards' incredible athleticism that allowed him to never be beaten by the pace of the ball, right? Forget his eye and everything else, but just his athleticism. And we know Sobers had a similar thing. AB de Villiers has a similar thing, right? These three, I'm just picking out three random guys, not random, but there are other guys as well, but they have that ability that not everyone else has. Virat, I think, would be another one that might have this as well, right? And it's that ability that when the ball is bowled very fast, that you can get yourself into the correct position at a rate that other people can't. Not just by viewing the ball and looking at it the way that Inzi would, but then by the quick, short, little sharp movements, right? Those movements are tiny, micro movements. If you're facing Shoaib Akhtar, you're not getting a forward front press very often, right? You're not even getting the chance to go all that far back. A little bit forward, a little bit back, a little bit inside the line, a little bit outside the line, whatever that may be. Compare that to spin. You actually need to, spin's much more of a balletic art. It's much more about footwork and weight distribution, right? And decision-making. Against fast bowling, a lot of your decisions are made beforehand. So they're very, very different skills. But we know that there's a reason why people do start to struggle. I mean, generally, against very fast bowling and against spin are the two first things that go. So having that little bit of athleticism that allows you to, you know, twitch muscle fibers, whatever it may be, that allows you to go forward, back, sideways, all these sorts of things, still plays a part. But that's very different than when you're facing a spinner anyway, because when you're facing a spinner, even if you're facing, I don't know, who's the fastest spinner, Rashid Khan, you're making multiple decisions. So Hertz, I went out to a spinner the other day in a game where I kind of made two decisions during the ball, right? So the first one was, oh, I should hit this really hard. And then as it came down and it was in the zone, I went, actually, I don't need to hit it this hard. What I actually need to do is just make good contact and hit it through the gap. And in the end, I kind of got lost between the two and hit straight to mid off and was caught, right? Very, very hard to do that against a pace bowler, especially a proper pace bowler. You can do it against a medium pacer. You can do it against, you know, even medium fast. Once you get to fast, right? Your one decision is your one decision. The second decision probably is not a decision at all. So they are very, very vastly different skills, even if the same kind of athleticism might help for both. But yeah. But your follow-up question, will a batter be steered towards something based on their skill sets? It happens over time, but it doesn't happen the way that, like, if you're 6'8" and you bowl a couple of fastballs, obviously you're going to be steered towards fast bowling. If you play the spinners pretty good when you're 15, 16, you probably don't start to bat at number five, right? As long as you're still good against pace. But over a period of time, if you keep showing that your best skill is coming in when the spinners are on, then you will be moved down the order. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. Ali says, what does Abbas have to do to become better than Asif? So I think Muhammad Asif is something different than Muhammad Abbas in that Muhammad Asif is a pioneer who has actually changed cricket forever. He also was probably a little bit quicker. And I don't know, was he taller? He felt taller. He felt like he had really long arms. So I don't know what his wingspan was. But he felt quite tall. The release of the ball, it seemed to have a little bit more bounce and zip on it. So there's a couple of things that he can do that Muhammad Abbas probably can't do, right? But Muhammad Abbas's main skill of just landing the ball on the same spot over and over again and not getting bored with it, Asif could get bored with it occasionally, is probably on a par. I think Muhammad Asif could do it on any surface at any time whenever he needed to. I don't know if Muhammad Abbas is quite at that level, probably because of the lack of like half a yard in his era anyway. But there's not much, you know, I mean, they're both great bowlers. But if you look at overall impact on the game, Muhammad Abbas can never have the kind of impact that Asif has had. If you're talking about test records, yeah, he could end up with a similar kind of record, but you'd have to go back and have a look at the pitches that they both bowled on as well. Mob says, we used to laugh about bad salesy jeets running English cricket, but with the appointment of Stephen Fleming, it seems clear that Rob Key is some kind of bizarre fetish for the Kiwis. Is this an affinity for the Walter Hadley, Coney, Crow pedigree of disruptors? Or number two, perhaps a love for the rugby All Blacks and their dressing room culture or something else? When I'm packing my arsenal for a test cricket series in Australia, I don't usually think, New Zealand. That's a fascinating one. I don't think they went out to try and get a New Zealand coach. You know, like if you actually look at what happened, I would say that Andy Flower was probably number one. Rahul Dravid was probably number two. Kumar Sangakkara was probably number three. Then you probably had Justin Langer at number four. Obviously, they had talked to Ashwin kind of off the record, on the recordy. Like as in, I don't know if they actually said, would you be a coach? Or they were like, is that something you're interested in? Am I missing someone else? Those are kind of the main ones that I'm aware of. I'm sure there's a few more. So Fleming isn't even on that list. I think once Flower is no longer available and Rahul Dravid and Kumar Sangakkara don't want it, you're either left with someone like Ashwin who hasn't coached before, someone like Langer who is a weird culture fit, a bunch of first-class county type of coaches, and then suddenly Stephen Fleming comes on the market. So I think it's probably more to do with that than anything else. You've got someone who's got a really good record, who's very well respected, who's been doing the job for a long time, who's an adult. I think those things matter. PJ says, which player's reputation is most dependent on the era they happen to be born into? Every player. I suppose there's a bunch of like English. That's maybe not true. There might be a bunch of like Australian players. Even though like someone like Greg Chappell, right? Doesn't really play in Asia. Doesn't really always play away that much. Plays pace bowling pretty well. We don't know how he would have played spin in Asia, really. Is he kind of on that kind of a list? I don't think that he's still a great player, but I think things kind of fell to him pretty well. Let me come up with someone better than him though. It must be a bowler. So Sydney Barnes is a really interesting one because Sydney Barnes is a seamer who swings it, who seams it, who spins it, right? Which is, you know, until we got to Mustafizer, we hadn't really had a second version of that. And he plays a lot of cricket in South Africa on matting wickets. his bowling average against Australia was much more normal. So if you take away the fact that on batting wickets, he was unplayable because he could spin the ball from ball one. Fazal Mahmood would be another one, right? You know, a guy could get, who could cut the ball on seam pitches, sorry, on matting pitches. I wonder what those guys would be like in other eras. I still think they're both probably greats, but very different kinds of greats, I would have thought. And then you've got all the English spinners who played in the wet pitch era, right? Who were probably good quality, you know, they were basically defensive bowlers most of the time. And then the wicket got damp and then they would end up just, you know, taking all the wickets. So that kind of like Jim Leaker type player is the one I would think of there. Ari says, why is Virat's, doubled up quite a bit today. Sam says, I follow both cricket and football closely, but my tolerance for the journalism and analysis punditry differ greatly, and I can never get enough of cricket journalists and ex-players just talking about sport or cricket. But I'm very impatient with the way that football is covered and only try and watch the actual matches and nothing else around it. Maybe that is unfair, but I don't actually find ex-professional footballers have very much to say of substance and actual insight to the sport. Why do we have such a love for one and such an aversion to the other? When the passion for sports is, he says he's a slightly bigger cricket fan. What do you think are the differences? So I think that traditionally, I actually don't think there's many things that are similar to cricket in that you were talking about a commentary stint, which goes for 7 hours. So storytelling is baked into it, right? That's not how football, we just come off the World Cup. So I've watched more football at the moment than I normally would have. Football is calling with little moments that are sometimes nice. And then reaction. And I've noticed with the footballers, when they cut back to them, they're trying to hit their points really quickly because they know they don't actually have that long, right? And I think that bleeds over into the after the match way that they discuss things as well. Whereas cricket is a constant discussion all the way through the day. And I think that changes things a lot. And I think it changes it with the writing as well. It's one of the reasons why I think T20 writing struggles. I remember Athers saying once that you can't put story or narrative into T20. That isn't true, right? But what is true about what he said is that, you know, for someone who does do narrative writing in sport, Test cricket is perfect. Because if I notice something early in the day, I have 7-8 hours to write that arc and follow that arc. If I'm a football guy, I have 2 hours? Something happens in the first 15 minutes, right? I can't, football, I'm assuming probably demands more of your actual eye energy. I know that sounds weird, but in cricket, you can look up and down. Right? Like if you're really good, if you become a really good professional cricket writer, you know, your ability to look up and down on a time limit is perfect. In fact, you know, sometimes I'll stop working if I can't get the timing right. But once I've worked out the bowlers and I can work this out, even if it's just at the end of the over, I'll be like, great, I've got this long. Now I do my work. That's not as easy in football. So football, again, is a much more reactionary thing from that. What's fascinating is that what has happened over the last few years in football writing has probably been that the feature narrative stuff and the analysis stuff is a lot better because they don't have time to put that into their pieces. Whereas you will quite often read a really good bit of analysis piece kind of in a match report of cricket, right? That shouldn't be really wedged into this little zone here, but is because of everything else. So they're very different tempos. And so I do think that changes it. And depending on what you like, Sam, you're going to gravitate towards one or the other. I've noticed in basketball how little I ever read match reports from basketball. And I think it's very similar to football. I would never do that. And yet I read features a lot. Whereas in cricket, I feel like I read more match reporty analysis pieces. And the longer narrative pieces, I probably don't gravitate to as much because I kind of feel like I've already got that from somewhere else already. Hope that helps. Jonathan says, based on your recommendation, I started reading Golden Boy. Tremendous book. Yeah, Christian Ryan's got a new book. Oh my God, Christian Ryan's new book. Is it Ryan book, cricket. It just came out. Has he got it on his website? They just sent it to me. Of course, he doesn't have it on his website yet. Oh my God. If I just click on him here, 11. Yeah, it is called 11 because I remember I had a book that I was going to call 11 as well, which I had changed the name from. Yeah, We Burned Them in the Sun. Haven't read it yet. Christian's a legendary writer, really good guy. Support him any way that you can. But I haven't read it yet. Is the true. I'm just having a look here. A bunch of very talented people seem to really like it, like Gideon and John Houghton. So all good things there. But yeah, haven't got to. I really like the cover too. But yeah, go have a look at it. But my perception of Lily and Marsh is now completely altered. They divided up the Australian camp and undermined Hughes' captaincy. You kind of get the sense that they were almost happy to see England win the famous both the Ashes. How did Lily and Marsh's reputation survive their actions? And is this the only instance of an Australian cricket team openly rebelling against the captain? It is not. Michael Clarke certainly had that. Don Bradman and his teammates is another one that's worth looking into. Do you want that? Just off the top of my head. They largely got away with it because they were legends and Kim Hughes wasn't. I think that's a really, really important thing. Also, if Kim Hughes wasn't Western Australian and he was from one of the other major cities or even one of the other cities in general, there would have been a natural kind of like the home journalist would have backed him a little bit more. But all three of those guys are from Western Australia and it's like the other two are legends, right? So I think there was an issue with that as well. There was also an idea of that Kim Hughes shouldn't have been the captain in the first place. And they basically only done that because of World Series cricket, which I think is probably very, very fair. And a lot of people felt that way. So I do think that that played a part in it. But it's a really interesting look. I think Dennis Lilley himself is a really complicated person. I haven't met him very much other than, you know, maybe shaking a hand and being briefly in a conversation with him. But from conversations I've heard, he can be quite a complicated man, you know, intelligent, driven, but, you know, he has his views on things, I think is probably fair to say. Rod Marsh I did meet a few times. I've got a lot of friends who absolutely love Rod Marsh. He was unquestionably one of the most rudest, abrasive people I ever come across in cricket. Outwardly a dick when I don't think he needed to be at times. I think some of it is just his demeanor, but it was hard to get through. But these were hard men who had, you got to remember, they had been basically banned from cricket in Australia. Absolute legends of the sport. Come back into the Australian team having what they think is done the right thing and got players paid more and, you know, got a bigger slice of the pie. And then kind of shadow banned, I think, at times by Cricket Australia because they were involved in that. I'm not, as I said, they're complicated people. A book on Rod Marsh would be a fascinating one because he did so many great things for cricket. But, you know, he could certainly say things. Complicated guys, but it's a great book and it's certainly worth getting if you've never read it. James says, discussions of Shane Warne often touch on his relatively poor record in India and the West Indies. Murali struggled in Australia and to a lesser extent India. Anil Kumble has a few countries where his record wasn't great. Who's the best spinner that didn't struggle in any particular country? I wonder what Bisham Baydy's record is everywhere. Because Bisham Baydy had some incredible spells in Australia, didn't he? Where are we? Yeah, struggled in England. I only played three tests in Pakistan, but didn't take any wickets there either. I think this is a fantastic question, James. And I think it's probably something that would need to be a complete feature. There's a reason why all these people had their issues. So I think Shane Warne in India is a lot of that is to do with the fact that he bowled slow. And those are pitches that you need to bowl a little bit quicker on, right? And also that Shane Warne and Murali both bowled up. And I think in India, at their speed, people had the ability to come down and meet them. And on the slower surfaces, even if the Indian players were slightly beaten, they could adjust. Whereas on faster surfaces, that's a much tougher thing to be able to do. I'm trying to think of Anil Kumble and where he was great and where he wasn't. I think Anil Kumble is probably, I would have thought his biggest issue is just that because he didn't spin the ball all that much. He didn't need a lot of spin, but he needed sort of some kind of spin. And so on surfaces like Australia, New Zealand, England, interestingly, a little bit better in South Africa, he was always going to struggle. I'll just have a look at Rangan Harath and then Jadeja as well. But yeah, so I do think there is an element of spinners are much more conditions and probably player dependent than a genuine fast. Like if you're a really good swing bowler, like Richard Hadlee, you're probably still going to do really well in England, right? Just because swinging the ball at pace, if you're on top of it, you should always be pretty good at being able to control that. So Harath struggled in England, India as well. Yes, I do think that is something that is worth looking at. And we'll just look at Jadeja at the end as well here. Where does he go? So Jadeja's 34. Wait, am I looking at his batting? It's a good batting record in Australia. 29 in Australia, so he's been fine as a bowler in Australia, which I thought was right. But then in England, he averages 50. And New Zealand, he averages 60. Yeah. I think that's probably going to be a pattern that we see again and again, really. I'd be shocked if that is not the case. Just because of the way that it works for spin, I think it's a little bit different than it is for pace. I don't think it's that much different. Like, I do think that it makes sense to me that Dale Steyn would do better in Asia than Jimmy Anderson, right? As a bowler. Because again, it's not that he's better. He is better than Anderson, but it's not that he's better than Anderson is the reason. It's that he is a hit the stumps bowler, skiddy person who is just that little bit faster and doesn't need as much assist from the conditions. And yet when Steyn goes to England, weirdly enough, he doesn't have a great record. And that's where Jimmy Anderson is the better bowler. And I think that you should get that pretty much across the board, but I think it should be more extreme for spin is what I'm trying to say. It's very hard to be like, I'm just trying to think of like what kind of spinner you would need. So you need someone who's fast, but also puts enough revolutions on the ball that they don't need assistance from the track. And also on occasion needs to be able to bounce the ball. Those three particular skills, I'm trying to think of a spinner that's ever existed like that. Perhaps Bill O'Reilly might have been one, but he didn't play much in Asia. I don't even know if he played a test in Asia. But he would have been perfectly set up for Asian conditions and certainly was perfectly set up for Australian conditions. I think bowled pretty well in England. Daniel Vittori, if he was faster and could do the same thing consistently, would be another one. Like a Suliman Ben, Daniel Vittori, Mitch Santner type of bowler. But yeah, I just don't think they exist all that much. Ali says, are you still bullish on the 100? That it'll continue to attract eyeballs and bums on seats. I don't know if I was ever bullish on the 100. I thought it needed to exist because English cricket had screwed up so much. I don't know if bullish is the right word. I still think it'll become a T20 tournament. I think it's fine. I don't know if I was ever bullish on it. Mob says, it's only a matter of time before the outside investment from IPL interests, international cricket bodies, sees some weird decisions being taken, possibly to integrate the biggest market, India, with the biggest event ever in cricket, the Ashes. How long can commercial interest hold out before there's one slot in Test 11s for an international player? Do you think Vaibhav Suryavanshi will live to play an Ashes Test? I think it's much more likely that Test cricket becomes franchise than there'll be ever an international slot for Test 11s. I don't see how that would work. I can see, I actually, maybe I look at this very differently. I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been Ashes Tests in other countries already, considering some billionaire or millionaire hasn't come along and just be like, why don't you just play one test here? So I could certainly see how playing a test match in India is something that happens. You know, we played tri-series 115 years ago, right? We like to think that this is a really conservative sport, but actually we have done other things before. And it's a bit weird that we haven't found a way to make more sort of exciting, explosive, marketable things happen before. I'm not against any of those. My worry is that you play a Ashes Test match in India and do Indian fans come? That's my only worry, is that does it even work, right? Like, do you really want 12,000 people in Ahmedabad, all right, or 15,000 people in Eden Garden? So you would have to make sure it would work. And I think that would be my bigger concern on all that. I think that Test cricket was a pioneer in sports and should continue to be a pioneer. And I don't see why we're not. It's brilliant. We should play more of it. All right. Let's just get into the super chats. I don't think there's many and I've lost one already. That's a good start. Yeah, I thought I clicked on that one. Where are we here? Ekant says, can there ever be a men's T20 greatest of all time who's better than the Test GOAT? Can there ever be? No, because Test cricket is fundamentally a much harder sport. So, I mean, if you just do it from that perspective, no. If you're talking about it from a point of view of, I don't know, let's say we have a Shohei Ohtani type cricketer, you know, a modern Keith Miller, who can bat in the top four in T20 cricket and smash the ball everywhere and is the world's best, you know, in the world's sixth or seventh best bowler and doesn't play any other format. Let's say Andre Russell was 15% better at bowling, for instance. I think at that stage, maybe you have a bit of a weird conversation about it, but you'd also then have to do it for like 15 years and win all the titles, wouldn't you? But if you're just talking on talent, it's really hard to do that just because it's easier to be really good at T20 cricket than it is to be really good at Test cricket, because it's just Test cricket is such a fundamentally harder sport to play. Varun says, chances the Indian team this time around in New Zealand. Also, will New Zealand finally win a Test in Australia after ages? I really like New Zealand's bowling lineup in Australia. I think Will O'Rourke, could not be more impressed with him of recent times. I thought he was a really good bowler before, and I thought maybe he could eventually get to this level, and he seems to have got there way quicker than I thought. They have an attack that should, on paper, be very well suited to modern Australian conditions and also traditional Australian conditions. Guys are whacking into the surface, guys who are tall, guys who are fast, guys who nip it around, guys who swing it, guys who seam it. All these sorts of things are happening in Australian cricket at the moment. So I could see why they could win a test. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't be putting money on it. I'd need to see the conditions and everything. But Australia's batting is pretty weak and the bowling lineup's old, a couple of injuries there. You know, if New Zealand played the teams that England were playing, you'd have to give them a really good chance. Oh, having said that, no one in New Zealand's ever been fully fit for a while. Chances the Indian team in New Zealand this time around, probably again depends on the bowlers. If they have Siraj, Bumrah, and, you know, whoever the other ones might be, and if they have their top four of their top five bowlers fit and one of them is Bumrah, they should, you know, give themselves a really good chance of winning the series. I don't think New Zealand's like an amazing side. I thought they played brilliant cricket against England, but I still thought they were pretty flawed. I think I'd be pretty shocked if India ran over them, but I think I'd be pretty shocked if New Zealand ran over India as well. It should be pretty close. The problem with playing a team like New Zealand, and we did a video like on them, a while back on the site, which is because they have so many bowling options, even when they have injuries, they become a really nasty little spoiler team. And so if you are a good side, they're not exactly the kind of team you want to go up against. Smalt says, saw the all format top 10 video. You mentioned World Cup matter less because of sample size, but don't they show who performs in big games? UV and head versus stat padding of Dawid Milan. Well, Dawid Milan wouldn't be on that list though, would he? Okay. So let's say you're Sachin Tendulkar and you've played, I don't know, 80, 50 games in a World Cup. And you are, let's just have a look here. See if I can bring this up very quickly. So what is he in? ODI cricket. I'm not going to do T20s, although I don't have to. Now I've said that out loud. Where are we here? World Cup. God, he's played even less than I thought. Sachin Tendulkar played 45 World Cup games, right? That's a pretty good sample size. I'd be willing to say that I'm pretty confident that Sachin Tendulkar has been tested in multiple situations and handled the pressure really, really well. If you've played 20, right, which is a normal career of a really good international player, right? Let's say for five of them, you came in under an injury cloud, just couldn't do the thing that you wanted to do. So your numbers are depressed. Let's say for five others, you have bad form. Perfectly normal thing. 0.25% of the time, you're probably going to be in bad form, even if you're a great player, right? Now, half of those World Cup games are depressed and the other half look great, right? Now, let's say there's another player who's played 20 World Cup games and just through pure stroke of luck, they were in the form of really good form all the way through. Maybe the form of their life in one edition, maybe really, really top form, and the other two just a plus, right? In your mind, Smort, that player is better than the other player. But I've just told you that this other person, dumb luck, injury, and dumb luck form. It's hard for me to look at a player's entire career and really give a lot of credence to one or two decisions. There are ODI bilaterals where teams are trying to rip each other's heads off, and there are World Cup games that are dead rubbers that don't mean anything, right? You have to look at everything. And if you don't look at everything, what you end up with is an incomplete thing. And you end up going, well, that guy was great because I mean, no one's sitting here saying Kevin O'Brien's one of the greatest players of all time, right? We know he's not. Kevin O'Brien wouldn't argue that he's one of the greatest players of all time. But Kevin O'Brien has some really interesting skill sets that work in certain situations. Ben Stokes has some really interesting skill sets that work in certain situations, right? And they have been able to use those when needed to absolutely go ballistic and change, you know, entire matches. That doesn't mean that those two are the greatest batters who have ever lived, because we know they're not. As far as stat padding, by the way, goes, Dawid Milan is a fantastic player who is very consistent at what he does. I don't need the fact that he didn't do well in World Cups to tell me he has a limit. The stat padding that you're talking about here is him having a very high average, but quite often scoring at a far slower rate than everyone else in the game. I don't need World Cups to work that out. I have the information. I also know from the fact that the IPL teams didn't feel confident enough to put him on their sides. I have plenty of information to tell me that Dawid Milan is not at the same level as Yuvraj Singh or Travis Head. Right? And you're factoring all these things in. If you bring it down to one thing like World Cups, you generally always make mistakes. Generally always? I don't think those two phrases go together. Generally always would be a great name for a band, by the way. Ben King says, if Root Brooksmith went in at 3-4-5 and Bethel at 6, thoughts on Jax to provide a proper batter and just above part-time span? Not sure I believe he's above part-time span. They then have Atkinson, Robinson, and Jofra. Okay, so my issue with this is I don't... So straight away, if you move Root, Brook, and Smith to 3-4-5, I'll leave Brook out of this. I think you get a slight discount on Root, and I think you get a slight discount on Smith. Maybe it's 8 runs. Maybe it's 12 runs, right? So you now need your number 7 to be able to make that up by his batting or via his bowling. You've also got a number six who's still learning the game, who's going to come in lots of difficult situations that they're not going to make any runs in. You know, I think Jacob Ethel, you're looking at someone averaging probably around 30 to 35. I don't think that's a big change from here. But you've got Smith, who is probably, I think, much more suited to batting at six or seven, coming in at number five. If he struggles and Bethel has to come in difficult situations, you now have to have Jax make the runs. I just think there's a lot of, this feels like a Gautam Gambhir side to me. You've got two part-time bowlers, or three if you want to include Root in this. So you've got three part-time spinners. I would go as far as to say that I'm not sure that Jax is that much better of a spinner than Root anyway. They're very different kind of off spinners. So you could use both of them in the one time, but I'm not sure he's that much better. I would probably go the other way. And if you were going to do this particular lineup, at number seven, I want someone who can genuinely get me consistent wickets. So that might be Rehan Ahmed. That might be Sam Curran. I would go in that direction because I want wickets. I don't want a bunch of part-timers, especially for the vast amount of test matches that England play. I just don't see how that really helps them. I'd be shocked if Bethel's bowling a lot in 4 years' time. Could be wrong, but I'd be shocked if he's bowling a lot in 4 years' time. I think we've seen that Will Jax is a part-timer. Are you hoping to get 1.5 wickets a game out of them combined? I'd rather get a bowler who could give me 2 to 2.5 wickets a game and then take the haircut on the runs. If this is the kind of lineup I was going at, I would rather bat Bethel at seven, give him a beautiful run and put a specialist and put Smith at six and bring in someone else to bat at number five in this exact situation, if that's what you wanted to do. I just think if you got Bethel and Root anyway, the thoughts of having another part-time spinner doesn't, at a certain point, how much part-time spin does any human being need? That's it for me on the Wagon Wheel this week. I'll be back again next week. Thank you to everyone for supporting us and everything else. Please subscribe to everything that Combox does. And if you do that, more things will happen. And at the end of the day, isn't that what we want? More things. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Rukshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.